Golda Weatherwax stood in the centre of the octagram and raised his hands. Urshalo, Dileptor, Kuhula, do my bidding. A small mist formed over his head. He glanced sideways at Trumon, who was sulking at the edge of the magic circle. This next bit's quite impressive, he said. Watch. Kot Bahai, Kot Sham. To me, O spirits of small isolated rocks and worried mice not less than 3 inches long.
What? Said Trumon.
That bit took quite a lot of research, agreed Golda. Especially the mice. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes.
He raised his arms again.
Trumon watched him and licked his lips distractedly. The old fool was really concentrating, bending his mind entirely to the spell, and hardly paying any attention to Trumon.
Words of power rolled around the room, bouncing off the walls and scuttling out of sight behind shelves and jars.
Trumon hesitated.
Golda shut his eyes momentarily, his face a mask of ecstasy as he mouthed the final word.
Trumon tensed, his fingers curling around the knife again, and Golda opened one eye, nodded at him, and sent a sideways blast of power that picked the younger man up and sent him sprawling against the wall.
Golda winked at him and raised his arms again.
To me, O spirits of...
There was a thunderclap, an implosion of light, and a moment of complete physical uncertainty, during which even the walls seemed to turn in on themselves.
Trumon heard a sharp intake of breath, and then a dull, solid thump.
The room was suddenly silent. After a few minutes, Trumon crawled out from behind a chair and dusted himself off. He whistled a few bars of nothing much and turned towards the door with exaggerated care, looking at the ceiling as if he'd never seen it before. He moved in a way that suggested he was attempting the world speed record for the nonchalant walk. The luggage squatted in the centre of the circle and opened its lid.
Trumon stopped. He turned very, very carefully, dreading what he might see. The luggage seemed to contain some clean laundry, smelling slightly of lavender. Somehow it was quite the most terrifying thing the wizard had ever seen.
He said, you wouldn't have seen another wizard around here, by any chance?
The luggage contrived to look more menacing.
Oh, said Trumon. Well, fine. It doesn't matter.
He pulled vaguely at the hem of his robe and took a brief interest in the detail of its stitching. When he looked up, the horrible box was still there.
Goodbye, he said, and ran.
He managed to get through the door just in time. Rincewind?
Rincewind opened his eyes.
Not that it helped much. It just meant that instead of seeing nothing but blackness, he saw nothing but whiteness, which, surprisingly, was worse.
Are you all right?
No.
Ah.
Rincewind sat up. He appeared to be on a rock speckled with snow, but it didn't seem to be everything a rock ought to be. For example, it shouldn't be moving.
Snow blew around him.
Twoflower was a few feet away, a look of genuine concern on his face.
Rincewind groaned. His bones were very angry at the treatment they had recently received, and were queuing up to complain.
"What now?" he said.
"You know when we were flying and I was worried we might hit something in the storm, and you said the only thing we could possibly hit at this height was a cloud stuffed with rocks?"
"Well?"
"How did you know?"
Rincewind looked around, but for all the variety and interest in the scene around him, they might as well have been in the inside of a ping-pong ball. The rock underneath was, well, rocking. He ran his hands over it, and felt the scoring of chisels. When he put an ear to the cold, wet stone, he fancied he could hear a dull, slow thumping, like a heartbeat. He crawled forward until he came to an edge, and peered very cautiously over it. At that moment, the rock must have been passing over a break in the clouds, because he caught a dim but horribly distant view of jagged-edged mountain peaks. They were a long way down. He gurgled incoherently and inched his way backwards.
"This is ridiculous," he told Twoflower. "Rocks don't fly. They're noted for not doing it."
"Maybe they would if they could," said Twoflower. "Perhaps this one just found out how."
"Let's hope it doesn't forget again," said Rincewind. He huddled up in his soaking robe and looked glumly at the cloud around him. He supposed there were some people somewhere who had some control over their lives. They got up in the mornings and went to bed at night in the reasonable certainty of not falling over the edge of the world, or being attacked by lunatics, or waking up on a rock with ideas above its station. He dimly remembered leading a life like that once. Rincewind sniffed. The rock smelt of frying. The smell seemed to be coming up from ahead, and appealed straight to his stomach.
"Can you smell anything?" he said.
"I think it's bacon," said Twoflower.
"I hope it's bacon," said Rincewind, "because I'm going to eat it."
He stood up on the trembling stone and tottered forward into the clouds, peering through the wet gloom. At the front or leading edge of the rock, a small druid was sitting cross-legged in front of a small fire. A square of oilskin was tied across his head and knotted under his chin. He was poking at a pan of bacon with an ornamental sickle.
Said Rincewind.
The druid looked up and dropped the pan into the fire. He leapt to his feet and gripped the sickle aggressively, or at least as aggressively as anyone can look in a long, wet, white nightshirt and a dripping headscarf.
"I warn you, I shall deal harshly with hijackers," he said, and sneezed violently.
"We'll help," said Rincewind, looking longingly at the burning bacon.
This seemed to puzzle the druid, who, to Rincewind's mild surprise, was quite young. He supposed there had to be such a thing as young druids, theoretically. It was just that he'd never imagined them.
"You're not trying to steal the rock," said the druid, lowering the sickle a fraction.
"I didn't even know you could steal rocks," said Rincewind, wearily.
"Excuse me," said Twoflower politely. "I think your breakfast is on fire." The druid glanced down and flailed ineffectually at the flames. Rincewind hurried forward to help. There was a fair amount of smoke, ash, and confusion, and the shared triumph of actually rescuing a few pieces of rather charred bacon did more good than a whole book on diplomacy.
"How did you get here, actually?" said the druid. "We're 500 feet up, unless I've got the runes wrong again."
Rincewind tried not to think about height.
"We sort of dropped in as we were passing," he said.
"On our way to the ground," Twoflower added.
"Only your rock broke our fall," said Rincewind. His back complained.
"Thanks," he added. "I thought we'd run into some turbulence a while back," said the druid, whose name turned out to be Bellafon. "That must have been you," he shivered. "It must be morning by now," he said. "Sod the rules, I'm taking us up. Hang on."
"What to?" said Rincewind.
"Well, just indicate a general unwillingness to fall off," said Bellafon.
He took a large iron pendulum out of his robe and swung it in a series of baffling sweeps over the fire. Clouds whipped around them. There was a horrible feeling of heaviness, and suddenly the rock burst into sunlight. It levelled off a few feet above the clouds in a cold but bright blue sky. The clouds that had seemed chillingly distant last night and horribly clammy this morning were now a fleecy white carpet, stretching away in all directions. A few mountain peaks stood out like islands. Behind the rock, the wind of its passage sculpted the clouds into transient whirls. The rock, it was about 30 feet long and 10 feet wide, and bluish.
"What an amazing panorama," said Twoflower, his eyes shining.
"What's keeping us up?" said Rincewind.
"Persuasion," said Bellafon, wringing out the hem of his robe.
"Ah," said Rincewind sagely.
"Keeping them up is easy," said the druid, holding up a thumb and squinting down the length of his arm at a distant mountain. "The hard part is landing."
"You wouldn't think so, would you?" said Twoflower.
"Persuasion is what keeps the whole universe together," said Bellafon. "It's no good saying it's all done by magic."
Rincewind happened to glance down through the thinning cloud to a snowy landscape a considerable distance below. He knew he was in the presence of a madman, but he was used to that. If listening to this madman meant he stayed up here, he was all ears. Bellafon sat down with his feet dangling over the edge of the rock.
"Look, don't worry," he said. "If you keep thinking the rock shouldn't be flying, it might hear you and become persuaded, and you will turn out to be right, okay? It's obvious you aren't up to date with modern thinking."
"So it would seem," said Rincewind weakly.
He was trying not to think about rocks on the ground. He was trying to think about rocks swooping like swallows, bounding across landscapes in the sheer joy of levity, zooming skywards in a... He was horribly aware he wasn't very good at it. The druids of the disc prided themselves on their forward-looking approach to the discovery of the mysteries of the universe. Of course, like druids everywhere, they believed in the essential unity of all life, the healing power of plants, the natural rhythm of the seasons, and the burning alive of anyone who didn't approach all this in the right frame of mind. But they had also thought long and hard about the very basis of creation, and had formulated the following theory. The universe, they said, depended for its operation on the balance of four forces, which they identified as charm, persuasion, uncertainty, and bloody-mindedness. Thus it was that the sun and moon orbited the disk because they were persuaded not to fall down, but didn't actually fly away because of uncertainty. Charm allowed trees to grow, and bloody-mindedness kept them up, and so on. Some druids suggested that there were certain flaws in this theory, but senior druids explained very pointedly that there was indeed room for informed argument, the cut and thrust of exciting scientific debate, and basically it lay on top of the next solstice bonfire.
"Ah, so you're an astronomer," said Twoflower.
"Oh, no," said Bellophon, as the rock drifted gently around the curve of a mountain. "I'm a computer hardware consultant."
"What's a computer hardware?"
"Well, this is," said the druid, tapping the rock with a sandaled foot. "Part of one, anyway. It's a replacement. I'm delivering it. They're having trouble with the big circles up on the vortex planes. So they say, anyway. I wish I had a bronze torque for every user who didn't read the manual." He shrugged.
What use is it, then, exactly? Asked Rincewind, anything to keep his mind off the drop below.
"You can use it to tell you what time of year it is," said Bellophon.
"Ah, you mean if it's covered in snow, then it must be winter?"
"Yes. I mean, supposing you wanted to know when a particular star is going to rise."
"Why?" said Twoflower, radiating polite interest.
"Well, maybe you want to know when to plant your crops," said Bellophon, sweating a little. "Or maybe..."
"I'll lend you my almanac, if you like," said Twoflower.
"Almanac?"
"It's a book that tells you what day it is," said Rincewind wearily. "It'd be right up your ley line."
Bellophon stiffened.
"Book?" he said. "Like, with paper?"
"Yes."
"That doesn't sound very reliable to me," said the druid nastily. "How can a book know what day it is? Paper can't count."
He stamped off to the front of the rock, causing it to wallow alarmingly. Rincewind swallowed hard and beckoned Twoflower closer.
"Have you ever heard of culture shock?" he hissed.
"What's that?"
"It's what happens when people spend 500 years trying to get a stone circle to work properly, and then someone comes up with a little book with a page for every day and little chatty bits saying things like, 'Now is a good time to plant broad beans,' and 'Early to rise, early to bed makes a man healthy, wealthy, and dead.' And do you know what the most important thing to remember about culture shock?"
Rincewind paused for breath and moved his lips, silently trying to remember where the sentence had got to.
"Is?"
he concluded.
"What?"
"Don't give it to a man flying a 1,000-ton rock."
"Has it gone?"
Trumon peered cautiously over the battlements of the Tower of Art, the great spire of crumbling masonry that loomed over unseen university. The cluster of students and instructors of magic far below nodded.
"Are you sure?"
The bursar cupped his hands and shouted.
"It broke down the hubward door and escaped an hour ago, sir," he yelled.
"Wrong," said Trumon. "It left. We escaped. Well, I'll be getting down then. Did it get anyone?"
The bursar swallowed. He was not a wizard, but a kind, good-natured man who should not have had to see the things he had witnessed in the past hour. Of course, it wasn't unknown for small demons, coloured lights, and various half-materialised imaginings to wander around the campus. But there had been something about the implacable onslaught of the luggage that had unnerved him. Trying to stop it would have been like trying to wrestle a glacier.
"It swallowed the Dean of Liberal Studies, sir," he shouted.
Trumon brightened.
"It's an ill wind,"
he murmured. He started down the long spiral staircase. After a while he smiled, a thin, tight smile. The day was definitely improving. There was a lot of organising to do, and if there was something Trumon really liked, it was organising. The rock swooped across the high plains, whipping snow from the drifts a mere few feet below. Bellophon scuttled about urgently, smearing a little mistletoe ointment here, chalking a rune there, while Rincewind cowered in terror and exhaustion, and Twoflower worried about his luggage.
"Up ahead!" screamed the druid above the noise of the slipstream. "Behold, the great computer of the skies!"
Rincewind peered between his fingers. On the distant skyline was an immense construction of grey and black slabs, arranged in concentric circles and mystic avenues, gaunt and forbidding against the snow. Surely men couldn't have moved those nascent mountains. Surely a troop of giants had been turned to stone by some...
"It looks like a lot of rocks," said Twoflower.
Bellophon hesitated in mid-gesture.
"What?" he said.
"It's very nice," added the tourist hurriedly. He sought for a word. "Ethnic," he decided.
The druid stiffened.
"Nice," he said. "A triumph of the silicone chunk. A miracle of modern Masonic technology. Nice!"
"Oh, yes," said Twoflower, to whom sarcasm was merely a seven-letter word beginning with S.
"What does ethnic mean?" said the druid.
"It means terribly impressive," said Rincewind hurriedly, "and we seem to be in danger of landing, if you don't mind."
Bellophon turned around, only slightly mollified. He raised his arms wide and shouted a series of untranslatable words ending with "nice" in a hurt whisper. The rock slowed, drifted sideways in a billow of snow, and hovered over the circle. Down below, a druid waved two bunches of mistletoe in complicated patterns, and Bellophon skillfully brought the massive slab to rest across two giant uprights with the faintest of clicks. Rincewind let his breath out in a long sigh. It hurried off to hide somewhere. A ladder banged against the side of the slab, and the head of an elderly druid appeared over the edge. He gave the two passengers a puzzled glance and then looked up at Bellophon.
"About bloody time," he said. 7 weeks the Hog's Watch night, and it's gone down on us again."
"Hello, Zachariah," said Bellophon. "What happened this time?"
"It's all totally fouled up. Today it predicted sunrise 3 minutes early. Talk about a klutz, boy. This is it."
Bellophon clambered onto the ladder and disappeared from view. The passengers looked at each other, and then stared down into the vast open space between the inner circle of stones.
"What shall we do now?" said Twoflower.
"We could go to sleep," suggested Rincewind.
Twoflower ignored him and climbed down the ladder. Around the circle, druids were tapping the megaliths with little hammers and listening intently. Several of the huge stones were lying on their sides, and each was surrounded by another crowd of druids who were examining it carefully and arguing amongst themselves. Arcane phrases floated up to where Rincewind sat.
"It can't be software incompatibility. The Chant of the Trodden Spiral was designed for concentric rings, idiot.
I say fire it up again and try a simple moon ceremony."
"All right, all right. Nothing's wrong with the stones. It's just that the universe has gone wrong, right?"
Through the mists of his exhausted mind, Rincewind remembered the horrible star they'd seen in the sky. Something had gone wrong with the universe last night. How had he come to be back on the disk? He had a feeling that the answers were somewhere inside his head, and an even more unpleasant feeling began to dawn on him that something else was watching the scene below, watching it from behind his eyes. The spell had crept from its lair deep in the untrodden dirt roads of his mind, and was sitting, bold as brass, in his forebrain, watching the passing scene, and doing the mental equivalent of eating popcorn. He tried to push it back, and the world vanished. He was in darkness, a warm, musty darkness, the darkness of the tomb, the velvet blackness of the mummy case. There was a strong smell of old leather and the sourness of ancient paper. The paper rustled. He felt that the darkness was full of unimaginable horrors, and the trouble with unimaginable horrors was that they were only too easy to imagine.
"Rincewind,"
said a voice. Rincewind had never heard a lizard speak. But if one did, it would have a voice like that.
He said. Yes?
The voice chuckled, a strange sound, rather papery.
You ought to say, where am I?
It said.
Would I like it if I knew? Said Rincewind.
He stared hard at the darkness. Now that he was accustomed to it, he could see something. Something vague, hardly bright enough to be anything at all. Just the merest tracery in the air. Something strangely familiar.
All right, he said. Where am I?
You are dreaming.
Can I wake up now, please?
No,
said another voice, as old and dry as the first, but still slightly different.
We have something very important to tell you,
said a third voice, if anything more corpse-dry than the others. Rincewind nodded stupidly. In the back of his mind the spell lurked and peered cautiously over his mental shoulder.
You've caused us a lot of trouble, young Rincewind,
the voice went on.
All this dropping over the edge of the world with no thought for other people. We had to seriously distort reality, you know.
Gosh.
And now you have a very important task ahead of you.
Oh, good.
Many years ago we arranged for one of our number to hide in your head because we could foresee a time coming when you would need to play a very important role.
Me? Why?
You run away a lot,
said one of the voices.
That is good. You are a survivor.
Survivor? I've nearly been killed dozens of times.
Exactly.
Oh.
But try not to fall off the disc again. We really can't have that.
Who are we, exactly?
Said Rincewind. There was a rustling in the darkness.
In the beginning was the word,
said a dry voice right behind him.
It was the egg,
corrected another voice.
I distinctly remember the great egg of the universe, slightly rubbery. You're both wrong, in fact. I'm sure it was the primordial slime.
A voice by Rincewind's knee said,
No, that came afterwards. There was a firmament first, lots of firmament. Rather sticky, like candy floss. Very syrupy, in fact. In case anyone's interested,
said a crackly voice on Rincewind's left,
you're all wrong. In the beginning was the clearing of the throat. Then the word. Pardon me, the slime. Distinctly rubbery, I thought.
There was a pause. Then a voice said carefully,
Anyway, whatever it was, we remember it distinctly. Quite so. Exactly. And our task is to see that nothing dreadful happens to it, Rincewind.
Rincewind squinted into the blackness. Would you kindly explain what you're talking about? There was a papery sigh.
So much for metaphor, said one of the voices. Look, it is very important you safeguard the spell in your head and bring it back to us at the right time. You understand? So that when the moment is precisely right, we can be said. Do you understand?
Rincewind thought. We can be said? And it dawned on him what the tracery was ahead of him. It was writing on a page, seen from underneath.
I'm in the octavo, he said. In certain metaphysical respects,
said one of the voices in offhand tones. It came closer. He could feel the dry rustling right in front of his nose. He ran away. The single red dot glowed in its patch of darkness. Trumon, still wearing the ceremonial robes from his inauguration as head of the Order, couldn't rid himself of the feeling that it had grown slightly while he watched. He turned away from the window with a shudder.
"Well," he said. It's a star," said the Professor of Astrology. "I think."
"You think?" The astrologer winced. They were standing in Unseen University's observatory, and the tiny ruby pinpoint on the horizon wasn't glaring at him any worse than his new master.
"Well, you see, the point is that we've always believed stars to be pretty much the same as our sun."
"You mean balls of fire about a mile across?"
"Yes, but this one is well, big."
"Bigger than the sun?" said Trumon. He'd always considered a mile-wide ball of fire quite impressive, although he disapproved of stars on principle. They made the sky look untidy.
A lot bigger," said the astrologer slowly.
"Bigger than Great Artuin's head, perhaps?" The astrologer looked wretched.
"Bigger than Great Artuin and the disk together," he said. "We've checked," he added hurriedly, and we're quite sure."
"That is big," agreed Trumon. "The word huge comes to mind."
"Massive," agreed the astrologer hurriedly.
Trumon paced the broad mosaic floor of the observatory, which was inlaid with the signs of the disk zodiac. There were 64 of them, from Wizen, the double-headed kangaroo, to Gahuli, the vase of tulips, a constellation of great religious significance whose meaning, alas, was now lost. He paused on the blue and gold tilework of Mubbo the Hyena, and turned suddenly.
"We're going to hit it?"
he asked.
"I'm afraid so, sir," said the astrologer.
Trumon walked a few paces forward, stroking his beard thoughtfully. He paused on the cusp of Okjok the salesman and the celestial parsnip.
"I'm not an expert in these matters," he said, "but I imagine this would not be a good thing."
No, sir."
"Very hot, stars." The astrologer swallowed.
"Yes, sir."
"We'd be burned up?"
Eventually. Of course, before that, there would be disk quakes and tidal waves, gravitational disruption, and probably the atmosphere would be stripped away."
"Ah. In a word, lack of decent organization."
The astrologer hesitated and gave in.
"You could say so, sir."
"People would panic."
"Fairly briefly, I'm afraid."
Said Trumon, who was just passing over the perhaps gate and orbiting smoothly towards the cow of heaven. He squinted up again at the red gleam on the horizon. He appeared to reach a decision.
"We can't find Rincewind," he said, "and if we can't find Rincewind, we can't find the eighth spell of the octavo. But we believe that the octavo must be read to avert catastrophe. Otherwise, why did the Creator leave it behind?"
Perhaps he was just forgetful," suggested the astrologer.
Trumon glared at him. "The other orders are searching all the lands between here and the hub," he continued, counting the points on his fingers, "because it seems unreasonable that a man can fly into a cloud and not come out."
"Unless it was stuffed with rocks," said the astrologer, in a wretched and, as it turned out, entirely unsuccessful attempt to lighten the mood.
"But come down he must somewhere. Where, we ask ourselves."
"Where?" said the astrologer, loyally.
"And immediately a course of action suggests itself to us."
"Ah,"
said the astrologer, running in an attempt to keep up as the wizard stalked across the two fat cousins.
"And that course is?"
The astrologer looked up into two eyes as grey and bland as steel.
"We stop looking," he ventured.
"Precisely. We use the gifts the Creator has given us, to wit. We look down, and what is it we see?"
The astrologer groaned inwardly. He looked down.
Tiles?"
he hazarded.
"Tiles, yes. Which together make up the—"
Trumon looked expectant.
Zodiac? Ventured the astrologer, a desperate man.
Right. And therefore all we need to do is cast Rincewind's precise horoscope, and we will know exactly where he is.
The astrologer grinned like a man who, having tap-danced on quicksand, feels the press of solid rock under his feet.
I shall need to know his precise place and time of birth, he said.
Easily done. I copied them out of the university files before I came up here. The astrologer looked at the notes, and his forehead wrinkled. He crossed the room and pulled out a wide drawer full of charts. He read the notes again. He picked up a complicated pair of compasses and made some passes across the charts. He picked up a small brass astrolabe and cranked it carefully. He whistled between his teeth. He picked up a piece of chalk and scribbled some numbers on a blackboard. Trumon, meanwhile, had been staring out at the new star. He thought, the legend in the Pyramid of Tsort says that whoever says the 8 spells together when the disk is in danger will obtain all that he truly desires, and it will be so soon. And he thought, I remember Rincewind. Wasn't he the scruffy boy who always came bottom of the class when we were training? Not a magical bone in his body. Let me get him in front of me and we'll see if we can't get all 8.
The astrologer said, gosh, under his breath.
Trumon spun around. Well?
Fascinating chart, said the astrologer breathlessly, his forehead wrinkled. Bit strange, really, he said.
How strange?
He was born under the small boring group of faint stars, which, as you know, lies between the flying moose and the knotted string. It is said that even the ancients couldn't find anything interesting to say about the sign, which...
Yes, yes, get on with it, said Trumon irritably.
It's the sign traditionally associated with chessboard makers, sellers of onions, manufacturers of plaster images of small religious significance, and people allergic to pewter. Not a wizard sign at all. And at the time of his birth, the shadow of Cori Celesti...
I don't want to know all the mechanical details, growled Trumon. Just give me his horoscope.
The astrologer, who had been rather enjoying himself, sighed and made a few additional calculations.
Very well, he said. It reads as follows. Today is a good time for making new friends. A good deed may have unforeseen consequences. Don't upset any druids. You will soon be going on a very strange journey. Your lucky food is small cucumbers. People pointing knives at you are probably up to no good. P.S. We really mean it about druids.
Druids? Said Trumon.
I wonder...